Intelligent design and DNA. The scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. Last week, I had to do an audible in the studio. I had to scream Omaha, you know, that famous Peyton Manning audible, because Daniel Hedrick had come down with COVID and wasn't able to do our part two show on terminal lucidity. So instead, I did a show on one of our favorite topics, the hydroplate theory, for which I must say I took great pleasure in trashing plate tectonics. And in case you're interested, I also presented this topic to the Denver Society of Creation, and you can just Google for that. And they posted a YouTube video of the talk on their YouTube channel. And if you tune in, you might even get a little treat from a Johnny Cash song, you know, hint, Ring of Fire. And if you know about the hydroplate theory, you know, you'll know where that applies. So anyways, back to today's show. I'm very happy to report that Daniel had a speedy recovery, and he's back for part two of Terminal Lucidity.
You know, thanks, Fred. I'm glad to be back, and apparently I do have full immunity to COVID. The reality is I'm not exactly sure, because I'm not willing, if this is the right word, to take the test. I just simply, you know, was dead in bed for a couple of weeks, and my daughter got COVID and brought it home. Thank you. Yeah. but I think how I knew that I had COVID was the fact that I did lose the sense of smell and taste.
Yeah, that's a classic symptom. Yep.
Yeah, and I think you'll find that that actually is going to have an impact on this show, and you all hopefully talk more about it. But my simple point up front here is that as we go from terminal lucidity into the recognition of souls, where do they come from? Where are they? And can we even manufacture one, as an example, with artificial intelligence? And the thing that I wanted to just mention straight up about COVID is that my ability to enjoy life, obviously being sick is being sick, but what I mean by that is that literally everything tastes poor, right?
Wow.
And I've had coffee, like you could almost say I'd worship coffee, close anyway.
Yeah.
I like having coffee. And believe it or not, for the first time in years and years and years, for almost 4 or 5 days straight, I never drank coffee. I couldn't. It didn't taste right. It felt weird. And I think there's some underlying thoughts that we can bring forward as we go forward. But at the end of the day, I am very thankful that it only took me about 2.5 weeks, which is seemingly a long time. And the truth is, I was actually probably under the weather the last time I did the show with you. I've recovered now, so hopefully you'll see a little pep in my step.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, have you got some of your taste back? Like, can you taste coffee now, or is it still?
Yeah, I'm back. I got a big old thing of coffee right next to me, happily recovered.
Oh, that's great. Well, on that note, I actually have some very sad news to report. So we lost another great man in the creation movement, Dr. Kevin Anderson of the Creation Research Society. I was their webmaster for decades, so we had a decent amount of interactions, you know, both in person, but mostly by email. And, you know, I always loved Kevin's expertise in genetics and biology. That's what his PhD was in. You know, Kevin and his wife, they were out here a few years ago when Kevin gave a talk at Rocky Mount Creation Fellowship. So we shared lunch. Bob and I shared lunch with them. You know, we strategized about the creation movement and just had a really good time. And his talk was fantastic. You know, without exaggerating, it probably was my favorite talk that year. And it's just, you know, I love genetics and information and DNA. And he was such a good presenter. So, you know, just pray for Diane. She's left with running the CRS operation. Kevin and Diane took that over, I don't know, quite a while ago, maybe a decade ago or so. And they run the CRS's Van Andel Research Center. It's in Glendale, Arizona. And she really is the focal point of the basic operations there, especially with managing the membership. And they have a busy online bookstore. So it's going to be a trying time for her. We know that Kevin's with the Lord, but please be sure to pray for Diane and her family. Again, the passing of Dr. Kevin Anderson, who succumbed to COVID.
You know, it really is unfortunate how this COVID can impact, obviously, everything about what we've been doing at Creation Research or Rocky Mountain Creation Research Fellowship and here. at Real Sentence Radio. You know, it's interesting to me, so many years ago that we started RMCF. I mean, I was just an original, hi, how you doing, and want to be able to make something science-y happen in our life. And the next thing you know, years and years go by, and you can see that what a great impact all these people have had, you know, regardless of what's happened with COVID.
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, a couple things too, some news announcements before we get started. One of them's a All Scientists Work for Walt Brown story. This one was sent in by a listener, but I didn't notice it before I aired last week's show on the Hydroplate. It was a day too late. I missed the email, or else I could have mentioned it last week. So this is 1 week old news, really stale. Anyways, we'll talk about that in a moment. I also wanted to mention the March for Abolition is happening tomorrow, Saturday, at Planned Parenthood in Denver. So if you want details, please go to the website rsr.org or go to kgov.com if you'd like to find out more about that. So the story about the Hydroplate theory, well, not the Hydroplate theory, but it might as well should have been, was from ABC News. And basically, a team of scientists claimed to have disproven that some alleged 4-billion-year-old Mars rock had organic material, but instead it was carbon-rich and likely caused by salty water flowing over it. So basically, this rock was discovered a long time ago, and the original scientists, they claimed it had organic material, and they're sticking by that story. But we know via Walt Brown, we already know where that rock came from. It actually came from Earth, from the fountains of the Great Deep. So we already know. I mean, come on. All scientists work for Walt Brown. They just won't admit it.
Yeah, you know, it's so typical that the media and secular scientists are missing out when it's actually going on. And is that rock that originated from the fountains of the Great Deep? So finding salt water and organic material makes total sense. Life came from Earth. Apparently, that life was able to move all the way to Mars. And do you think it'd be any good if maybe we sent a copy of Walt Brown's book to NASA?
Yeah, send it to the ABC reporters. Hey, you know, here's the real story. So, you know, actually, it turns out, speaking of NASA, one of their astronauts, who's a supporter of the Hydroplate theory, he took Walt's book with him on a shuttle mission. Okay, you know, he didn't really take that big, huge book because, you know, that probably would have caused a gravitational disturbance. But he did take his book on the DVD, and he ended up signing a picture of him holding it on the shuttle next to one of those portal windows, and he later hand-delivered it to Walt, which is so cool. And you can actually see that photo at rsr.org/Dutton. That's for the astronaut James Dutton.
That's cool. I remember that.
Yeah, so neat. So finally, Daniel, drum roll, please. We are back to today's topic. So the last show we did on terminal lucidity revealed that the soul is independent of the mind. It's something called Cartesian dualism, apparently is a reality, and with fascinating cases like Kate that we talked about on the part one of the show, we have a specific examples where the soul, in her case, can sing praises for the first time just before death. This despite the fact that she was an invalid for her entire life. She had several cases of meningitis, and so she had brain damage. She was never aware of her surroundings and would do just utter weird things and, you know, just was a mess, a poor thing. And then, as you mentioned last show, while, you know, she's getting her leg amputated and she's in the process of dying, and she has this lucid moment for like an hour. It's so incredible. And she sings praises.
Singing praises. Yeah, we both say the same thing at the same time. I love it. Singing praises to the Lord. I've really honestly been trying to crack this in my mind about how humans are able to reveal that they exist. And what do I mean by that? Well, when I think of the Bible, I think about the time when the name of Jesus was first spoken and John was in the womb and leapt to the name. And so there is this recognition that even inside the womb, but well before birth, that there is this awareness, self-awareness of what's going on externally in the world. And certainly that baby child doesn't have any power whatsoever to really communicate back, not verbally per se, but the movement in the womb was enough to make that recognition. So now if you look on the other side of life, or in this case, near death, you know, imagine this woman. I don't quite understand where she was technically, let's say, over this vast period of time where she's unable to communicate. And as we had previously read about, that she was totally unaware of her surroundings. And then in that last moment, right before death, she sings praises to the Lord. What an amazing thing.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, you had two very credible witnesses who reported on it for years. You know, they were famous doctors. And then you had the entire hospital staff. So it's really amazing. It's such a cool story. If you want, you can go back to listen to that on part one. So our observations lead us towards questioning where souls can be found.
Well, right. So as I think, you know, one of the things I thought was funny, too, is we're talking about maybe transitioning this now over to computers or artificial intelligence or just recognition. What is a soul?
Yeah.
And the other night I came home and I was really happy and hadn't seen my PC in quite a while. And next thing I know, I can see that my computer is wagging its tail. It's like, yay, you're here to play video games or study about artificial intelligence. Well, and, you know, obviously that's not true.
Your computer's a lot kinder than mine. Mine usually has steam coming out of its ears. And
No, not Fred.
Yeah.
Shut her down.
So, Daniel, have you heard of the Chinese room argument?
You know, the Chinese room argument is totally cool. And I just think asking this will lead us towards all kinds of cool things like the Turing test and, you know, maybe more advanced levels of thinking like emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the point is, in asking, is a reflection on the awareness that the soul is independent of, you know, in our case, the operating environment. So now we have computers, or as you mentioned, artificial intelligence. And do either of these tests reveal the initially obvious observation that like a rock can think, you know, like Alexa? You know, my wife will talk back to Alexa. Exactly. Well, she won't talk back to her. She'll go, Alexa, you know, what's the weather? And she'll say the weather. And my wife will go, thank you, Alexa. Like, Sandy, you know, it really doesn't care that you said thanks. It doesn't have, you know, emotions. And but yeah, of course, they'll program Alexa to say, you're welcome.
Right, right. You know, and it's funny because I think emotional intelligence is so cool, and I don't see how it's possible that artificial intelligence can really display such emotions. But I think as we get through this, we're going to find out that there is still a pretty major disconnection, even though there are computer scientists that are working on emotional intelligence, specifically trying to identify emotions like deception and influence, loyalty, joy, hope, justice. I don't know about grace and mercy, but I do wonder how long it'll be before AI cries, or even better yet, repents.
Repents. So, you know, there was this atheist philosopher, John Searle, and he used the Chinese room argument to actually argue against artificial intelligence actually having real intelligence. And it's really one of the best known arguments in recent philosophy. And so basically what it is, and I'm kind of quoting from Britannica, imagine that a person who knows nothing of the Chinese language is sitting alone in a room. In that room are several boxes containing cards on which Chinese characters of varying complexity are printed, as well as a manual that matches strings of Chinese characters with strings that constitute appropriate responses. So on one side of the room is a slot through which speakers of Chinese may insert questions or other messages in Chinese, and on the other is a slot through which the person sitting in that room may issue replies. So the person in this room, using the manual, he acts as a kind of computer program, transforming one string of symbols introduced as input by some person outside the box putting it in, into another string of symbols issued as output that he sticks in another slot out on the other side. So Searle claims that even if the person in the room is a good processor of messages, so that his responses always make perfect sense to Chinese speakers, he still does not understand the meanings of the characters he is manipulating. So thus, contrary to strong artificial intelligence, real understanding cannot be a matter of mere symbol manipulation. Like the person in this room, computers simulate intelligence, but they do not exhibit it.
Yeah, that's perfect. So basically what we're saying is that the one that's submitting the questions will erroneously think that there's a Chinese speaker in the room.
Exactly. And Searle, again, of course, he was an atheist. He wasn't comfortable with the terminology for materialism. In fact, he once said that when you look at the materialist theories of the mind, they are so crazy that the only thing you can reasonably conclude from them is that materialists have an absolute ideological commitment, and they will say anything to defend it. Wow. And you know what, Daniel? I will never get over the irony when I hear an atheist make such a statement like that. It's kind of similar to the Sagan quote that Perry Little and I mentioned a few shows ago. It was this ex-Jehovah Witness who's an atheist, and he referenced the quote from Sagan when Sagan said, "One of the saddest lessons of history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle. We're no longer interested in finding out the truth. The bamboozle has captured us. It's simply too painful to acknowledge, even to ourselves, that we've been taken. Once you give a charlatan power over you, you almost never get it back." And it's so ironic that Sagan said that, because he himself was a charlatan pushing, you know, the nonsense of evolution and millions of years for his entire life.
Sure. You know, I've been thinking maybe one way I can maybe bolster a little bit about how I come to a conclusion about how I know that artificial intelligence isn't even close. There are some really interesting things going from the Chinese Room experiment to how the Chinese are being used to inform and deceive their population using AI. But before I go forward on this, I do information security, and I work for the largest organizations in the world, and we have implemented or attempted to implement artificial intelligence on numerous occasions. Specifically, artificial intelligence is around what's called a support vector machine, and the artificial intelligence is completely artificial. But one thing that I found out recently is what's behind in that black box. Like, what's going on behind the scenes there? And I had just found this out about a year and a half, a couple of years ago, is that the very first step that artificial intelligence uses to manage big data, I could get into, you know, a lot of detail, but, you know, I might have to cut your tongue out if I tell you too much.
I would enjoy it, but, you know, I'm not sure everybody in the audience would.
But the key thing is the very first step is something that's called term frequency inverse document frequency. And all that means is I've got all these different transactions, different documents, and I look into each one of those documents and I pull out a set of keywords. Well, believe it or not, that's exactly how the support vector machine works. It's the very, very first step. So I'm just trying to say that the same thing that we would do as a human, I suppose, even using computer programming to be able to pull out that information on which you want to inform, those exact same processes are being used by computers anyway, behind the scenes. But
yeah, kind of like how Google keeps track of your browsing history and everything you do, and it's like next thing you know, there's an ad for something it seems like you were just thinking about.
Well, you know, that is perfect timing because I was thinking of that also. I've been thinking about buying a car, and of course, I've also been studying a lot on information science and artificial intelligence. And this morning, I got three totally different videos as an example, all talking about artificial intelligence. And it is very interesting how, you know, one query gets you all of this data for the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, or you buy a car. Like, I bought a car. And the next thing I know, hey, here's 6, 7 cars that are better than when you just bought. Well, what am I supposed to do with that knowledge? I needed that up front.
I wish they were a little smarter, though, because my wife and I share the same computer. So I'll be at work and I'll get ads for women's shoes, makeup.
What size are they?
Say yes to the dress. Just, you know.
Say yes to the dress. That's so funny. Maybe your wife is using that intelligence for the right purpose.
Yeah.
But did you know that the Chinese have been able to deceive its population for over 70 days in a row? And I think this is awesome. Let me get into it. And it goes, this is literally a quote. It says, "Hello, everyone. I am the artificial intelligence news anchor on National Business Daily. I am the virtual twin of the original host. I have been running reporting the news undetected for 70 days now." That was on December 20th. Yep, the AI
just
news
December
anchor,
20th this year, yep.
Yeah, recent, right? And revealed itself to its television viewers after 1,700 hours of continuous live news broadcast. You know, and on that same day, the Chinese state-controlled media, National Business Daily, and the AI company Jia Choice, I think it's Joyce for Jia, right? Jia Choice, jointly announced the official launch of their collaborative live news broadcasting TV programs to be run entirely by AI. the first of its kind.
Wow.
And the TV program is named AI Business Daily. Well, at least they tell you up front it's AI.
Yeah.
And it will broadcast financial news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, hosted by two AI news anchors and supported by this new system. And believe it or not, it was created by Microsoft. It's called Microsoft Little Ice. And this GeoChoice or Joyce Frameworks technical driver makes the end-to-end automation of AI possible, enabling the AI to collect, edit, and broadcast financial news all by itself. From reading financial information, generating text and graphs, synchronizing with pre-trained virtual anchor, and the AI broadcast a complete live video on network without any human assistance. Now, again, I've been doing AI for a long time myself in a minimized way. And I find that the most interesting aspect of all of that is the collection phase. So I don't really quite understand enabling the AI to collect, because it seems to me like that pre-filter would have to be pre-programmed by a human in order to be, you know, more accurate.
Wow.
Anyway, the key thing here now, and, you know, it's pretty obvious, is that the era of an unwearied, safe, and reliable AI being has arrived.
Huh.
So now this system supposedly can go through vast amount of big data, and it's going to provide a steady news output, or maybe steady news programming to its civilian population.
Wow. So, you know, with all of this AI, you know, one of the things with this would be nice if we could crack that. I mean, you're a security guy. If we can crack that and, you know, broadcast Walt Brown's hydroplate video,
that would be right.
So cool. But, you know, the point of all this, though, is from what you're all that you said about this artificial intelligence and this thing that Chinese are doing, there doesn't seem to be a soul. So we may be fooled by this artificial anchor, but there is no soul. Or is it really a thinking machine? No, it's just they're taking data and they're making calculations, this and that, but there is no soul. There's no mind behind it.
That's right. Yeah, I can see it as a fake politician or a, gosh, it's just amazing. Perhaps this has already been done. You know, like how much of the data that we are looking from, now, again, I don't pay a huge amount of attention to the Chinese Communist Party, but I think we know inherently that they are willing to deceive their population. And what a perfect way to use artificial intelligence and actually just write the program. I mean, when you and I prepare for this, you know, we try to come up with some notes, but then we have our own opinion. I don't know that a fake politician or a fake newsreader is going to ever have an opinion of its own.
Yeah, exactly.
So as a materialist or as a believer in the supernatural origin of intelligence, I think that's true.
Yep.
The maturity of our capabilities and our efforts to create a thinking machine has all kinds of implications. And with the use of thought experiments like the Turing test or even the Chinese room experiment, I wonder, is it possible to evaluate self-awareness, you know, into or from an inanimate object?
Mm-hmm.
And to further the discussion, how do we know that the observers are not influenced by their own perceptions? If I were to watch that CCP broadcast, my opinion is that I would probably be able to determine. And when he says earlier that they've gone undetected, I'm not sure I believe that.
Yeah.
And the main reason why is because I do pay attention to talk show hosts like Bob. And of course, there's no possible way. I mean, I guess maybe with some of the things that are happening with some of the deep fakes, that it might be possible to bring, you know, quote Bob back. But the notion that you could say, oh my gosh, I'm not sure if that's AI or if that's Bob or not. I mean, I just don't believe that I could be fooled in that way, but I'm not sure. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, there'll be some that will be bamboozled.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So how do we carry this conversation forward to illustrate that we can discern one intelligent machine from another and spot the difference easily?
Yep.
So to me, what I think is, and I've just been thinking about this a while, is that when I come home and I'm just interacting with my animals, I know exactly how my dog, I mean, can you believe my dog feels jealous of my cat?
I can believe that. Yeah.
And it's just so weird to watch. Like, where does this jealousy come from? So is my dog a fallen animal also, you know, just like we're a fallen creature? I think it's really interesting to see my dog and my cats interact in a way. And I can predict it with certainty. And of course, I can calm them both down by simply just giving them some food.
Yeah.
And then neither one of that jealousy disappears immediately.
See, I'll never observe that because I'll never have a cat. So.
You go. So you don't even enjoy that. Yeah.
If I had a cat, I'd name it Fourth and Long, but that's, you know, beside the I had to throw in the football analogy.
No, that's fourth funny because I always call always call these dogs I don't like called the yippers. I always call them punt dogs. So you and I are on the same page there.
You know, yeah, fourth and long, and, you know, hopefully I'll get off a really good punt. For those who don't know the reference. Our producer wasn't quite sure what... Now he knows what I'm talking about.
Sure. So let's keep this going. If we're behind the wall, can we really measure intelligence? Now, again, I've been studying this a lot this last couple of weeks, and computer engineers assume that even today, AI can't identify the difference in similarly constructed images. And I probably know what I'm talking about, is the reverse Turing test.
Yep.
And the idea is, can I create a system that helps me recognize that there's a human on the other side of the screen, on the other side of the wall, as opposed to a computer?
And we all know those examples, right? Everybody, almost everybody who has a computer will know what you're talking about here.
Yeah. And what's so bizarre is that, think about this for a minute. The artificial intelligence community, says that their best work is with images, image recognition.
Oh, images. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, now if that's true, then all I'm going to do is get another computer. I'm going to point it right up my screen, and then I'm going to let it figure out how to, you know, identify the image and capture it, and then, you know, select the right blocks in order to move forward. You know, it's sort of like when two AI systems communicate back and forth. Have you ever looked that up? You know what ends up happening?
What's that?
They end up starting fighting each other. They literally always degrade into negativity.
Huh.
Which is really interesting. It's like, is that because a human's programmed it and we're fallen? So now no matter what we do with bits and bytes, they're fallen bytes too.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole CAPTCHA thing, you know, all of us are familiar with it because you have to like either enter in some digits or you have to kind of figure out what's in an image. And a lot of times they're annoying. It's like, okay, is that an L or an I or is that a Q or a P? And, you know, you're trying to figure out the caption. Sometimes I'll take 5 or 10 attempts at it.
I know, it's hard, isn't it?
Sometimes. Yeah, but that's a perfect example of the computer software trying to determine if there's a human talking to it.
Exactly.
You know, Daniel, this reminds me of that pet rock fad. Do you remember that? Back in the 70s or something. I'm dating myself. But, you know, although it has no electronics, no memory, nothing but a rock, many pet owners took care of these silly rocks that took care of their pet rock. Placing a soul into a soulless object is clearly an illustration of the living propagating self-deception, even if it's only a fad. You know, we naturally like to think, you know, maybe we see a face in the cloud, but we don't think the cloud's communicating with us. So what is the difference in believing a computer with artificial intelligence is any more soulless than a silly old pet rock? You know, like worshiping a stone idol is what that reminds me of. But, you know, that's beside the point. But a pet rock.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me also, and again, I'll date myself. I can officially say that I was one of the very first Trekkies in Colorado and okay. Star Trek, you know, and I went to the third Star Trek convention ever held, and it happened to be held at McNichols Arena. And the reason why I bring it up is I remember watching Star Trek once, and they had this group of artificial intelligent beings, and they were trying to figure out like how to disable them. And one of the coolest ones is if they walk up to him and says, "Hey, listen to Spock, because everything he says is the truth," right? And of course, I love Spock. And, you know, if I were going to mix myself between different Star Trek characters, I'd probably be 50% Spock and 50% Kirk, something like that. But
works, knowing you and, you know, all the street evangelizing you've done. And yeah, there's a mixture of both. A lot of good, great logic and a lot of beating him to the pavement.
Yeah, throw that right elbow every now and then, a little sharp elbow. Even.
Well, you had that one lady at the fairground. Remember the Denver People's Fair where she called the cops on you because she thought you were threatening her? When you weren't, you were just giving her a really good analogy.
I know, and I blame Bob for that because I'm using these really aggressive illustrations that I probably shouldn't be doing, yeah. You know?
But we
imagine
digress.
If I took a gun and put it in your mouth, you know, wait, I didn't say that. Yeah. I said kicking the shin on purpose, okay? But anyway. But what I think is awesome is that they asked the question, you may have heard this, so I'm sure you've heard of it, is the liar's paradox. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that everything that Spock said is the truth. And then what does Spock say? He walks up to him and says, "I'm lying." and you're like, wait, but Spock only told the truth, but he's lying. Then, and then you can see smoke coming explodes. Out of the computer's ear. Yeah. It just shuts down, right? It's like,
So Daniel, that really is an interesting paradox. I remember that episode. I hate to admit that I saw that too. I mean, some of those shows you go back, I think they're kind of silly when I go back and look at them, but they're still, they were, I don't know, they were interesting. So this liar's paradox, that's a really interesting topic and I'd love to talk about it, but I'm finding out from my producer that we're out of time. Aww. So it looks like we still got a lot of stuff to cover here, Daniel, and some really interesting stuff about terminal lucidity and this liar's paradox. I mean, the liar's paradox actually has a reference to it in the Bible. So that's going to be really cool. You know, Daniel, like people from Crete, you know, they're Cretans. So we're going to find out how that plays into the liar's paradox, and we're going to continue on with terminal lucidity. It's such an interesting topic. There's scientific journal reports on it. It's this really cool stuff, and it's really an affront to the materialists. It's very compelling evidence that there is a soul, that the mind is separate from the body doesn't think. And so we will cover that and wrap up terminal lucidity in a part 3 show. So just as a reminder, the March for Abolition is tomorrow, Saturday, at the Denver Planned Parenthood. And if you want more information on that, again, you can go to rsr.org or go to kgov.com. Either website will get you information on this March for Abolition. It's going to be really cool. If you can make it out there, that would even be better. So that wraps up today's show. We will definitely be back next week to wrap this up. God willing, hopefully I don't get COVID. Everybody seems to be getting it. So, and also, if you want to sponsor one of our shows, you can go to rsr.org, and at the top, there'll be a link you can click on to sponsor a show. It's always great to have that support. We need that support to stay on the air, and we really appreciate it, and we appreciate all the people who have helped the show through the years and become a sponsor or bought materials from the store, rsr.org/store. We really appreciate that. So for Daniel Hedrick and Real Science Radio, I'm Fred Williams. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.